Welcome to another episode of the Client Experience Architect Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Hoskins, and it is my passion to guide you through crafting unique experiences for your clients to help you both maximize the value you bring and create a sales force of ranting, raving fans out there promoting your business. It is my pleasure to bring to you businesses who are crushing it with intentional customer-centric experiences and dive into what that looks like now, what it has looked like over the life of the business, and what it will look like in the future of their business. My goal is that you can snag some valuable insights to implement into your business after listening. Let's dive in. This episode is brought to you by the CX Architect System. The CX Architect System is my passion to bring the same tools that are available to large businesses with large budgets, such as Disney, to those businesses who don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to spend on crafting unique experiences for their clients. I've recorded a quick 15-minute presentation that guides you through three secrets of my system. The three secrets touch on how you can begin creating unique experiences in your business that will maximize your per-client revenue and create a sales force of raving fans to promote your business. Through that, you will avoid losing clients to competitors and avoid obtaining negative reviews. Head over to cxarchitectpodcast.com/raving fans to watch the presentation. And now, back to the show. On this episode, I am honored to share with you the conversation I had with Ari from Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Zingerman's started in 1982 with a deli and has grown to have a large community of businesses that you'll hear more about in the conversation. Ari's thoughts and views on the client experience are incredible, unique, and game-changing. You're really going to enjoy this one. Now, we had a quick change in audio recording options available, so please listen closely. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Ari from Zingerman's. Ari, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate your time, and it's truly an honor to have you on.
Well, I'm honored to be on, so right back at you.
I appreciate that. So, can we begin by diving a little bit into your background, your story,
sure.
You know, how you've gotten started, where you are, you know, where you are now, and how the business started, just kind of that line.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it well. I grew up in Chicago. I came to Ann Arbor, which, for those who don't know where Ann Arbor is, it's about 4 hours drive east of Chicago, and about an hour west of Detroit, so we're on I-94. Anyway, I came up to Ann Arbor to go to school at University of Michigan. Studied Russian history with a particular focus on the anarchists, which we could talk about later if you want. But
sure.
I graduated with my history degree. Of course, there isn't anything you can do with a history degree, which was not a shock or anything. I was supposed to go back and get more degrees, but I failed miserably. And visioning is the visioning process, or getting clear on a vision of the future, is a huge piece of our business approach and philosophy. But when I graduated, I had really no vision at all. I had only what David White, W-H-Y-T-E, the writer and poet whose stuff I really liked, calls the via negativa. And he says that's when you're clueless about where you want to go, but you're very clear on where you don't want to go.
Sure.
And I only knew I didn't want to go home, and or not go home, I needed a job. And I had driven a cab a little bit while I was in school, which wasn't particularly terrible, but wasn't all that uplifting either. And one of my roommates was waiting tables in a restaurant, and it seemed like he liked working there. So I went in and applied for a job as a server, and they interviewed me and said they'd call me when something opened. And I waited a couple weeks, and they hadn't called me. So I went back, and I reapplied again as a busser, and they said they'd call me, and I waited two more weeks, and they hadn't called me, and I went back, and I was, you know, like, I'm really running out of money. Do you have anything? And they said, offered me a job as a dishwasher, and, you know, I didn't know that that was an undesirable job in the industry, so I just said, sure, I'd be glad to wash dishes, and that's how I started. So I really just got lucky because I stumbled into work that I really, really loved doing, and also into great people. So I came to quickly, or relatively quickly, love food and cooking and love the food business. And also, I met great people, as I said. So I met Paul Saginaw, who's been my partner in all this from the beginning, was the general manager at that restaurant. Frank Carollo, who's one of the partners in our bakery, was a line cook. And Maggie Bayless, who's the partner at Zing Train, which is our whole training business, where we teach seminars and stuff, was a cocktail waitress. So I don't really know why we were all in there together, but we were. And we're now almost 40 years later, we still like each other and we're still working together. So anyway, so that's how I got going. Frank started teaching me how to prep and line cook, and I started managing kitchens. I stayed and worked for that restaurant group for about 4 years. Paul left about halfway through that and opened a little fish market here in town, which is still there, called Monahan's. And he and I stayed friends. You know, we would talk off and on. And in the, by the fall of 81, I had been there almost 4 years, and it was starting to get, you know, it's not like I hated going to work, but I was kind of less and less. Well, I mean, it wasn't like terrible. I mean, I just was less and less inspired by the work. And I liked the content of the work, but I didn't particularly feel aligned with where their organizational vision, they didn't have one in writing, but where they seemed to be heading and how they seemed to want to work as leaders. And so I just decided it was time to get out of there. So I gave 2 months notice, not knowing what I would do next. And Paul happened to call me 2 days later, and he said there was this little building coming open near the fish market that we should go check out. And where he grew up in Detroit, you could get good deli food, and in Chicago you could get it, but you couldn't get it here in Ann Arbor. So somehow within about a week, we decided we were going to open a deli. And then somehow within 4.5 months, we were open.
Wow.
Which I have no clue how we went that quickly. Today, it can, no joke, take 4 months to get a meeting set up when everybody's in town. But anyway, that's how we opened. So 1,300 square feet, me and Paul, two employees, you know, 25 sandwiches, some retail, what would now be called specialty food items. You know, squeeze into a little tiny space with 29 seats. And fast forwarding to today, to answer the other half of your question, I don't know what we have, 12 businesses all located here in the Ann Arbor area. That's part of our vision. And a big thing for me is to be doing business in the community that I live in and part of. And they're all different. We don't open multiple units of the same thing. So we have, the deli has been expanded 3 times, so it's grown a lot since its first day of opening in 82. But we have Zingerman's mail order. We ship food all over the country. We have a little coffee roasting, a candy business, wholesales to cafes and restaurants, and retailers are all over the area. We have a little creamery where we make fresh cheese and gelato. We have an event space called Cornman Farms, where we renovated an 1830s barn and farmhouse where we do weddings and corporate stuff. Zing Train, I mentioned, is our training business. Zingerman's Roadhouse is a sit-down restaurant where we do all regional American food, beer and wine. And then Miss Kim is a little Korean restaurant. And our newest formal business is our food tour business, which is very small, but it's kind of cool. So all told, we will do about $63, $64 million in sales this year, and we have about 700 people that work here. I could go on at great length, but there you go.
Sure. Well, how incredible. Thank you so much for taking some time to explain that and kind of go into that backstory. Can I ask you a question? Can we talk about some how you view the customer experience and how you are, you know, you kind of touched on it. Your vision is to kind of stay in Ann Arbor and kind of create this where you live. And so can you talk about the client experience and the customer experience in those businesses and how you're creating that as well?
Yeah. Well, I think Paul and I, you know, were very clear from the beginning, although obviously we've learned a lot over the last 37 or whatever years, but you know that the burden was on us as a business to make it worth the while of our customers to come in and spend their money and their time and eat with us, right? So, you know, as we always knew then, and it's even more true now, I mean, there was a million places people could go to get something to eat, and it's not like we had some exclusive, you know, we were the only ones selling food within a 30-mile radius. So So we were always very clear from the beginning that we needed to give great service and provide really great food in order to give people reasons to come back. I think together those create the experience, along with what I now would call the energy, you know, of the place, the energy of the people, the energy of the interaction. And our mission statement, which we wrote in 1991, so 9 years in, actually the first line of it is that we share the Zingerman's experience. So it's really, ultimately, it's all about experience. All of this, of course, was happening before the idea of an experience economy and all that existed. But the point from the get-go was really like, you know, we got to make you go like, wow, that was really amazing. I want to go back, because otherwise they're going to go somewhere else and we were going to be out of business.
Yeah, no doubt. So you touched on something that I really dialed in on, and I'd like for you to unpack a little bit for us and our listeners, the energy of the people. Can you kind of explain? It seemed like it just came off your tongue, like that was just part of a culture, but I'm curious if you could talk about if that's intentional or, you know, how that came about.
Yeah. Yes, I can talk about it, and yes, it's intentional. So, a good friend of mine's name is Anise Kavanaugh, A-N-E-S-E, and Kavanaugh with a C. Might be somebody that you want to have on the show at some point, but I'd be glad to connect you. But that's really her work is around energy management, and that's where I learned it, and we've sort of adapted it from her over the last 10 years. And she teaches her own stuff. In fact, she'll be in Ann Arbor this month teaching, and we reference her work regularly. But she brought up the idea of energy at a time where I was, so when in 2007, I mean, we wrote our third organizational long-term vision, and in there it talked about having 380% more fun when we get to 2020, which is when the vision was set. That was one of many things in the vision. And immediately after that, or relatively soon after that, a lot of people working here started to have meetings to how to figure out how to get to 380% more fun. And then they started arguing about fun. And then they started trying to organize fun. And all I could think was like, all I know is what y'all are doing is totally not fun. And, you know, but Paul has taught me many good things over the years. And one of them is a little saying that says, when furious, get curious. And I tried to reflect because, you know, of course, it wasn't like they were doing something bad or wrong. I mean, they were taking our vision seriously, which is exactly what we want. And so I tried to reflect on what was happening. And I realized, you know, with food quality, early on in the business, we had realized that we needed to get clear between the difference between how we defined quality at Zingerman's, so on a professional level, versus what people might choose to eat or like out of work, right? Because what they choose to like or eat out of work doesn't have to be the same as what we sell, but we need to help them understand what the difference is, because quality is not just your opinion. You're getting consensus or agreement around a definition. And so we defined quality in food as full-flavored and traditional food. And then at that point, it was really easy to say, hey, if you want to go home and eat fast food, totally your call, but that's not what we're going to serve here. But I realized in this dilemma was that we had failed totally on defining what fun meant. And so people were getting all caught up in arguments, as they would have done with food had we not done that work to get clarity of definition. So around that time is when I met Anise and got to know her work around energy. And that's when I quickly realized, okay, I get it. Positive energy is our definition of fun on a professional level, because we've all worked or played basketball or played music or been in a theater production or whatever, where it can be exactly the same people as the day before, but the day before everybody was bumping into each other and in a bad space, and the next day same exact people, same exact team, whatever, but things are flowing really, really well, and it's all about the energy. So we took her work and we adapted it to what we do here, and we actually now teach energy management to all the staff. It's a performance expectation, so it's not extra work. It's part of the job, is to bring positive energy. We talk about it regularly. It's on people's shift notes. It's on their whiteboards. We're open book management, so a lot of them track it. So it's very much a part of the culture, and it's taught.
How do you go about teaching that?
Well, it's real than teaching anything else.
Sure.
It's actually easier than teaching people how to make a cappuccino or bake bread. I mean, it's so we have I've written about it in Zingerman's Guide to Good Leading Part 2. Has a couple essays about it where I get into this in more detail. But basically, we teach three elements of energy. The first is your physical energy, and we talk about how to manage that. The second is your mental energy, or you could call it your emotional or spiritual or intellectual energy, so sort of the inside part, and we talk about how to manage that. And then the third, which I learned from a niece and it blew my mind because it made so much sense, is what she calls vibrational energy. And that's really the energy everybody's picking up from us. So it's not what we think we're doing, it's what everybody else thinks we're doing. And so we teach people about those three. And then we have a little simple recipe that we teach, which is four steps. The first is to read your energy. We use a 0 to 10 scale, which correlates well with our work with Net Promoter Score, which I'm sure you know all about. And so 10 is great and 0 is terrible. And so we start by reading our energy. The second step is we vision the energy. So at the end of the shift or at the end of a difficult customer interaction or a difficult conversation you're going to have or whatever, where do you want your energy to be? Because if you don't set your intention, the odds are low of getting where you want to be. The third is to manage it, because we're all different and we need to be self-aware enough to know, you know, what to do. So like I can go almost all day and barely eat, and other people got to eat every 2-3 hours, right? Or I'm an introvert, so I need time away from everybody to get myself regrounded. Other people want to be together, you know, and it's not one or the other. It's awareness of one's own needs, patterns, and tendencies. And then the fourth step is to repeat it, because as soon as we get grounded, something weird in the world is likely to happen. You know, a difficult customer interaction, or in our world, a couple plates drop and, you know, shatter on the floor, or can't find an order, or you know, whatever could go wrong.
Sure.
At some point will go wrong. So we actually teach that to everybody, and then we, you know, it's become well integrated into our culture, and I think it makes an enormous difference.
What an incredible insight there. I'm over here just jotting down notes like crazy. Can you go into some feedback? So how do you get feedback from your clients, and then how do you intentionally implement that?
Yeah. So there's another little book I wrote called Zingerman's Guide to Giving Great Service. And in there, a lot of this is talked about, but we have a little methodology for documenting complaints and then also for documenting compliments. We call the customer complaint, and a complaint here could be neutral almost. I mean, it's just like they're asking for something in a different color or whatever, so they don't have to be upset, but they're making a request from us. So those are called code reds, and then compliments are called code greens. So we, you know, our charge for all of us who work here is to document the ones that we hear from the customers. And I without question, we don't get it everything perfectly documented, but if you capture 2/3 of them, or even would be great. And then those, you know, in each business, we'll do it a little differently, but get reviewed regularly. So most of them will go over them at their weekly huddle, which is part of the open book management regimen. In the bigger businesses, there'll be one or two people who are charged with going through all of them and putting together, you know, some kind of report where they can pull trends or, you know, significant issues. But basically, that's how that works. So that's one big piece. We also do Net Promoter Score, which we call Zingerman's Experience Indicator. So we changed the name of it, but we do that, and that each business, because we are in different businesses, we do it different ways. So mail order sends a quick survey at the Roadhouse. Surveys go down with the check at the table, you know, so different people gather it in different ways. And then again, for people who do Net Promoter Score, they already know, but, you know, you're generally getting some good feedback out of those that we can work on too. So those are, you know, the two most common formal ways. You know, we've done some mystery shopping. I mean, there's no rocket science to it. And then I think really one of the biggest things is just being present. So it's not like any of us, you, me, or anybody else is going to be present everywhere all the time. But I think, like, I don't actually have an office, and so I try to get out into the businesses pretty regularly. that's where I spend most of my work time. You know, and people will say stuff because you're there that you won't, they won't tell you if they don't see you. So I think that's huge. And then there's an essay also in part two of the book about something that I just started doing really out of need in an unplanned way, but has remained a regimen for me, which is certainly not perfect, but I pour water at the roadhouse every evening to work the floor. So it just started out of walking in one night and customers at a table needed water. So I started pouring their water, and then I looked at the next table and they needed water. Just kept going, and before long I realized it was actually a really great way to be constructively helpful to the staff and the customers, but also learn a lot at the same time, because it gave me a way to sort of see what was happening and help deal with complaints, you know, see how people were eating the food, see what was going on, but not just be that what I always find unpleasantly obnoxious management presence where they're standing there watching over people in a, you know, sort of slave master kind of way, but more I'm actually contributing something constructive to the work and doing all the little, you know, scut work, because I'm picking up napkins off the floor and cleaning up spills and all the things that need to get done. So I think if one's only doing that work, you're immersed in the business and you can't do the work on the business. But I think if one's only working on the business, it's very easy to lose touch with the realities of people's daily life. So every industry is different, but if there's a way to sort of find where you could do an hour a week or an hour a day or whatever, I really think it makes a huge difference to understanding the customer experience and the staff experience.
Wow. That is, it's so unique how you think about that and how you dove into where you saw a need. And like you said, it was a unique way to interact with the clients or the customers, you know, by helping them. And then you receive the feedback and you're able to have a direct pulse exactly on what they're thinking and feeling during that time when they're actually engaging with your service.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's, like, I'm all for data gathering, and I think there's a lot to be gained from checking trends and all of that. But it's just, in addition to that, there's also data. You can lose the individual in the data, and I don't think it has to be either or, it can be both, you know. But if 98% of your customers are happy, you still have a lot that aren't, and there might be great insight to be gleaned from the 2%, but it's very easy to blow it off, you know, burying them in the statistics.
That's so good. So talk
to me. Conversely, if you don't have statistics, then it's very easy to get emotionally overwhelmed by one who's really upset, you know, but they might be the only one.
Yeah, that's a good point. Help me understand what you think is most important when it comes to your customers across all the businesses. How do you visualize that? How do you kind of conceptualize the importance that you can bring?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of like, what's the importance of air?
Sure.
I mean, if there's no customers, that you don't exist. So I guess it seems to be easy for some people to forget about the customer. But I guess for me and for Paul and I think most everybody in our organization, you know, although we could slip here and there, of course, like all humans, it's pretty clear, like, you know, if there's no gas in the car, it's not moving. If there's no customers, we're out of business. So, you know, I mean, just very commonly customers will go like, you know, I'm really sorry to bother you. I'm like, you're not bothering me. You're why I'm here.
Exactly. That makes sense. So what has been one of your favorite challenges or failures that you've faced, and how has that actually set you up for later success?
Well, I think we're all failing and succeeding simultaneously every day. You know, so I think if we are, you know, everybody knows the platitudes of learning from mistakes. It just, you know, it's not always emotionally easy to do that. But clearly that's one of the keys. You know, I think that one of the biggest things that we try to do here is to teach everybody from the beginning of their employment to think like a leader and teach them how to run a business. And I think that's a huge difference between what we do and most places do, because most frontline people have no clue how the business actually works or what's going on. They just know their job. And I write about this in an essay, and also coincidentally in part two of the book called, it's about the energy crisis in the American workplace. And I think when people are disconnected, which is the basis of the industrial model, when they're disconnected from the whole and assigned to do a specialized task only, they make really bad decisions because their information is so limited and so skewed, right?
Right.
So when you teach them how the business works, partly that's financial, but also just teach them how to think philosophically like a leader, and you know, coach them and turn them loose within a healthy construct, the odds go up drastically that they're going to do better work, right? But most businesses, they've, you know, assigned people to follow a system, and I'm not down on systems, but there's systems still need human thinking.
Sure. Well, and that ends up...
Especially service systems. And that service systems are, you know, for me, I would call generally, and obviously every industry is different, but generally they're craft systems. So in the same way that, you know, a great carpenter who's building a special home, they have to look at the wood and feel the wood and make their decisions accordingly. And yes, you have a blueprint, and yes, the blueprint gets them close to success, but a master carpenter is going to tell you that this piece isn't going to work and we got to go back and get another piece.
Sure.
You know, and the same is true with service. And you can design the system, but the right answer for the first customer could be completely the wrong answer for the third customer. And we need to be able to teach people how to distinguish.
That's good. Good stuff. Could you take us? Let's take a time machine trip back to your 20-year-old self.
Mm-hmm.
If you, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
I don't know, but I mean, I think all the stuff, like the whole part three of the leadership series, is about self-management. So I guess you could invert the question. It's all the stuff I've learned, or not all, but much of what I've learned since then in terms of self-management. I mean, just, I didn't know any of this, you know, about visioning, about free choice, about owning one's life and, you know, not needing to conform with what other people want you to do. And, you know, it's hard. It's Rollo May, the amazing 20th century psychologist, said the opposite of courage is not cowardice, it's conformity. So many of us spend our lives either conforming or fighting conformity, but actually fighting conformity is locked in to the conformity is following it. So
sure,
you know, finding a third path where it's really us creating our lives in the way we want to do them is really the work. I actually have a new pamphlet will be out very soon, which is about my belief that business and life are like art, and that the more you're creating your life or your organization in an artistically sound, artful, whatever way, the more interesting it's going to be, and the more careful and mindful and attentive you're going to be to the nuances and the details that make it up.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that insight. So what is one key takeaway from our conversation for our audience to implement in regards to their own, you know, client experience or customer experience in their business?
Well, you know, I don't know what one is. I mean, one is it's a life project. You know, just like a great musician, they never get it perfect. And even if they play a great show, they just start figuring out how to make new music or make it better. And I think it's the same with this. Also, I think the visioning process, which I referenced only briefly, but I write a lot about in the books, and we teach a lot about a Zing Train at our 2-day seminar, is huge. So if you don't have a vision of where you're going organizationally, if you don't have a vision of what it means to deliver a great experience, if your staff don't have a vision of what their role is, it's very hard to get where you want to be if you don't know where you're going. So the visioning process and our approach is very different than other people's. Is very, very powerful. And then the most recent book I did is on beliefs, and it's a whole nother interview and another conversation, but we all have beliefs about pretty much everything.
Sure.
And basically our lives are us playing out our beliefs on stage. And if people have, you know, if somebody's in a role that requires them to deliver great customer experiences, but they have negative beliefs about people, it's never going to work.
Sure.
Like, you could force them to behave in a certain way on the surface, but their vibrational energy, back to our earlier conversation, will always be, you know, come across as phony, because their real belief is that the customer's out to get them or cheat them or take advantage of them.
Wow. So I know you just mentioned your new book. Are there any other exciting projects or new things you've got coming up that you want our listeners to know about?
Well, that's pretty good. The new 600-page book on beliefs, which includes essays on hope in the workplace and spirit of generosity. And then I got this pamphlet coming out on business as the art of business, which is the epilogue of that book. But it's also got an extended interview that I did to expand on the subject. And we had to cover the pamphlet letter. We do a series of pamphlets, which are the individual essays out of the business book series. But this one is actually, it's special, and it's not in the books. The interview's not in the books, so we actually have designed it in a special way. So the cover is going to be letterpressed by a guy named Michael Coughlin in Minneapolis, who does beautiful work. And, you know, that's pretty good.
Yeah. No, that's great. Thank you so much. So how can people... how can our listeners keep up with that, you know, kind of find you? How can they do that?
So my email is rzingermans.com. They're welcome to email me directly. Zingtrain.com will get them to our training seminars. And then with the books and stuff, we do all the design and everything here ourselves, and we print them here in town. We're sort of off the grid. So they're on zingtrain.com also, our training business, or at zingermanspress.com. Either one would have them. We're sort of out of the mass market.
Well, perfect. Well, Ari, it has been such a pleasure. It's clear that you're passionate about your client's experience, your business, and I thank you so much for taking this time and sharing that with us, and I appreciate you.
My pleasure. I appreciate you. Have a wonderful day, and let's keep in touch.
Yes, will do. Thanks, Ari.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening in on another episode of the CX Architect Podcast. As always, we'd love to get your feedback on this episode and other episodes. If you liked it, if you pulled out any nuggets to implement, things like that. Also, if you like this episode and you're listening on your phone, take a quick screenshot, post it to Instagram or Facebook, and let me know what you thought, and then use hashtag CXArchitect and tag me in it so I can see your feedback. You can also head over to CXArchitectPodcast.com to find the show notes and a place to leave some feedback. Please let us know what you'd like to hear more of, and if you like the show and believe others might benefit from it, we'd love if you'd share it up and leave a 5-star review on iTunes, and doing that will help more people discover the show. And with that, I appreciate you, and thank you for listening. Have an awesome day!